presiding, your silence is commanded.
Right, please be seated. Calling our second case of the morning, Alan Gall versus Aurora Healthcare Incorporated, 21 AP 1787 FT. Appearances, please. All right, good morning. All right, good morning. The lineup this morning is 25 minutes, followed by 30, and 5 minutes in rebuttal. Is that your understanding? Okay, let's proceed then, please.
Chief Justice, and may it please the court. This court need not decide which form of treatment for COVID is best. Rather, it is simply called upon to ensure that the Wisconsin Healthcare Power of Attorney statute is properly interpreted so that the rights it proclaims are not merely suggestions that hospitals can ignore at their pleasure. We ask this court to reverse the appeals court decision that changed the intention of the legislature and effectively gutted the rights of patients protected by the Wisconsin Healthcare Power of Attorney found at 155, Wisconsin Statute 155. This statute declares that patients have the right to refuse treatments preferred by their hospital and receive medical treatments withheld by the hospital, even though they are necessary. These rights can be transferred to the principal's healthcare agent if the principal becomes unable to make the medical decisions himself. The plain meaning analysis of this statute under this court's settled precedents is that these rights are not mere suggestions, but convey and protect actual rights. My second point is that the appeals court's premature intervention in this case disrupted the party's agreement, which was a modification to the circuit court's order, and it makes clear that the patient-requested treatment was protected by the healthcare power of attorney statute. To explain further, when the appeals court took this case, an agreement had already been reached by the parties, and you can see that at 448 and 489 of the appendix. Opposing counsel sent a letter to the court confirming that agreement with local counsel, and that you can find at page 490. And I have a copy here of that agreement.
Counsel, this is a case where we're reviewing a decision of the trial court. You know, we're not looking afresh at the laws to determine whether anything could have supported such an order. I didn't see anything in the trial court citing any actual law that would support the decision in this case. Traditionally, if you don't cite the law, if you don't make a legal argument for why you're going to issue some sort of injunction, you've erroneously exercised your discretion. So my question to you, at least one of my questions to you, is what law did the trial court actually cite in support of its argument that there was a reasonable likelihood of success on the merits?
Thank you for the question, Justice Hagedorn. The court went through the different elements that are required for an emergency TRO. They did not memorialize it in writing, but they went through it a couple of different times with Attorney Ralph Lurigo. First of all, there was the irreparable harm that would be caused without an order.
There's obviously four different factors, right, for a temporary injunction. Irreparable harm's its own thing. I know there's arguments about status quo. I'm going to put all those aside for a minute.
Okay.
One of the requirements in order to issue a temporary injunction, and these would be a reasonable likelihood of success in the merits. The merits has to be some legal authority for a court to intervene and issue an order mandating some action. The trial court, in my reading, did not cite any actual law to support its order. Even I mean, the Court of Appeals, you know, rested its decision largely on that grounds. Even the dissent didn't point to any actual law that was cited. Or at least relied upon to show why there's a reasonable likelihood of success on the merits. So just on the reasonable likelihood of success on the merits, what law was cited by the trial court to give it authority to issue this order?
The trial court did not identify a specific law. I believe it was relying on its inherent powers because of the exigent circumstances of this case and the dire situation that we believe that John Zingzheim was in that particular case.
So then I think we're in agreement. If they didn't cite any actual law, then they erroneously exercised their discretion, and that's the end of the case, because they didn't cite, you know, reason through any legal authority to do what they did. I understand now you're making some arguments, which I don't think the trial court relied on, about healthcare power of attorney. You make some, again, arguments about inherent authority, but the trial court didn't invoke those issues that I think we relied upon. So why isn't that fatal to your case here? And obviously the rest of the case is moot because the gentleman here is obviously no longer hospitalized, and so it's not a present reality.
Your Honor, this case has a much wider reach than just Mr. Zingzheim. I just wanted to mention that, first of all. And he is out of the hospital. But there are people across the state of Wisconsin that very much need to know where the court would find on the health care power of attorney. And I do believe that the statute for the health care power of attorney is central to this case because it was Mr. Gall that brought the case. And so whether or not the court specifically cited it, we were relying on the rights that were in the health care power of attorney statute because Mr. Gall was the health care agent, and he stepped forward and asked for the medicine in the same way that he basically put himself in the shoes of his principal. And so that is where the court would have been coming from, even if they didn't specifically cite the statute.
Go ahead.
If I'm asking you what the rule is, what I'm hearing you say is, we want you to rule that even though the circuit court did not cite any law, we want you to disregard that in your ruling, Supreme Court, and we want you to say that as long as an individual has a power of attorney and is acting as a principal, they can come in and ask for anything. They can ask for a treatment such as ivermectin that has not been approved to treat COVID. They could ask for any type of medicine in any type of situation as long as a power of attorney has been signed. Is that what you're asking us to do here?
No, that is not what I'm asking you to do. Clearly, we had proven to the court that there was irreparable harm that would be caused and that there was no other adequate remedy at law, and that in order to maintain the status quo, which we believe
that... How do you know that you proved that to the circuit court? What finding did the court make regarding irreparable harm?
Regarding the irreparable harm, the court relied on Alan Gall's statements as the health care power of attorney, and in his affidavit, which you can find at page...
I'm not asking about the affidavit. I'm asking, what did the judge say? What factors? How do we know the judge considered certain factors? As a circuit court judge, right? I was a circuit court judge. Mm-hmm. And you say, I've listened mm-hmm. to all the testimony, and I'm making mm-hmm. the following findings. And then you talk about the findings that you are making based on the testimony that you've listened to or the evidence that has been submitted. What findings in this case did the judge make regarding irreparable harm?
The court found, based on the statements of Alan Gall in his affidavit, that Mr. Zingzheim was in dire circumstances and that the hospital had no other treatment. They were offering nothing else other than a ventilator for him. And because of that, the irreparable harm was found. And he did orally go through this with attorney Ralph Larigo.
So, piggybacking off that question by Justice Krofsky, what are the limits that you're saying this was the inherent authority of the court to do this, right? Because there was no law cited. We've all agreed on that. So no law cited, inherent authority of the court. What are the limits on that? Could a court, when presented with any situation under its inherent authority, issue an order? I mean, where do we stop here if you're saying that that's the inherent authority of the court?
Thank you for the question. It needs to be necessary. That is what the statute says.
What statute?
That would be statute 155.
Okay, and I do want to get to 155. So 155, what is, you're saying, where in 155, which point 30, sub 1, is that where you're relying on?
Right.
Okay, where does it say there about anything about being necessary? Where does it say anything? I mean, where does this give the authority at all for the court to act?
The first page of the health care power of attorney. You can find it in the statute. And the statute, this is the first page of the of the statutory form. And it basically says, notice to a person making this document, you have the right to make decisions about your health care. No health care may be given to you over your objection, and necessary health care may not be stopped or withheld if you object. Withheld, of course, being the key word here.
Necessary, the key word here?
Necessary is also a key word. I would agree with that.
I want to go back to the irreparable harm question because I'm not understanding at all how this is working out. The irreparable harm means that someone is going to be harmed and it's not going to be able to be repaired, right?
That's
is there
correct.
Any medical testimony in this record that supports the conclusion that the patient in this case, given his then existing medical condition, which was that he didn't have COVID at that time, was likely to experience irreparable harm if he didn't receive 66 milligrams of ivermectin a day for 5 days?
Your Honor, there is Senate testimony by Dr. Pierre Corey that is in the record, and he is considered the first expert.
He didn't ever see this patient, right?
He did not.
And he didn't sign his affidavit, is that right?
No, he did not.
And he doesn't even mention this patient in the affidavit that is filed in this case, isn't that right?
That's true.
So I'm going to ask you again, what medical testimony in this record supports the conclusion that this patient, given his then existing medical condition at the time of the hearing, when he no longer had COVID, was likely to experience irreparable harm if he wasn't given 66 milligrams of ivermectin a day for 5 days? It seems to me like it goes the other way, that the irreparable harm would have happened had he been given ivermectin, according to the CDC, the FDA, all the information that we've received by the AMA in this case, and all the other supporting documents supplied by your friend on the other side.
Your Honor, I would refer you to the National Institute for Health, Chart 2E, and this is found on page 333 to 334. And so this is a government document, a government entity, and their position on this is that when you look at the chart, you see that remdesivir is the first drug in line, and the second drug is ivermectin. And for ivermectin, the safety concerns are that it's generally well tolerated. And for remdesivir, they say renal and liver toxicity. And these two drugs are at issue in a number of cases throughout Wisconsin and I would submit around this country. And the issue is that the hospital is consistently withholding ivermectin because it falls beneath what they would say is the standard of care. What I would say is it is the COVID-19 protocols which are coming out of the federal government.
Has the FDA approved ivermectin as a COVID-19 treatment?
It has not.
It's a drug that treats infections caused by parasites, right?
That's true.
Okay. And according to the AMA amicus in this brief, an overwhelming majority of studies found that ivermectin is not effective in treating COVID. I'm wondering if you can point to any studies or research that have found otherwise. I understand you're giving me a listing of drugs that have been used to treat COVID, but I'm not hearing from you about a study or research or anything like that. Is there any credible evidence showing ivermectin effectively treats COVID?
Your Honor, there is a great deal of evidence, anecdotal evidence, and you can find much of it in the Senate testimony that was put forth by Dr. Pierre Corian is in the record.
But we're not here for anecdotal. We don't do anecdotal.
I understand.
We do expert. We don't do anecdotal. I could give you anecdotal for just about anything. Give me a situation. I'll give you an antidote for it. That's not what we're doing.
Perhaps to expedite this line of questioning, there is, in fact, a study that is Appendix B to the amicus filed by the Veterans Liberty Law Firm, Review of Emerging Evidence Demonstrating the Efficacy of Ivermectin in the Prophylaxis and Treatment of COVID-19.
Right, and I don't know if it's part of what you gave us or what I read getting ready for this, but I have read articles that people were very, very concerned about COVID when it would hit Africa because they are generally poorer and less access to health care. But actually, they've had a very low rate of COVID. Why? Because there's a lot of parasite infections, and people are on ivermectin prophylactically for that problem, which is of concern in that country. And so they haven't had the problems with COVID. And in the article that I read, it was suggested that was another reason that we should look more carefully at using ivermectin.
That's true, Your Honor. And
so can I take you to the bigger picture of the question that Justice Kropsky is asking? And that's this. You're saying the court should be able to use its inherent authority and look at what is a healthcare power of attorney, which really says that the person is stepping into the patient's shoes for purposes of care. Where does this line get drawn? You're saying this is necessary, you're saying withheld, you're construing that as if you don't get what treatment you want, that equals withheld. What about bloodletting? I mean, bloodletting was a very common way of treating all kinds of illness. What if someone comes into the hospital and says, I want bloodletting? That's where they put, I don't even know what kind of insects.
Fish, isn't it?
Something.
It's
fish.
Leeches.
Leeches. Right. Leeches. But there are people that believe that that is the way that you treat illness. And what if someone comes in and says, they are withholding treatment from me? Because that's how you're reading this. Because they won't give me the treatment that I want it. Where does this line get drawn, and how would we ever, as a court, be able to draw these kinds of distinctions that you're asking us to be able to draw?
First of all, Your Honor, thank you. It has to do with the word necessary again. And first of all, we have to have a patient, a person who is in dire straits. That was true in this case. And secondly, you need to make sure that it is safe and that is reasonable. And as I said, with the NIH document, they had very little concerns with the safety.
But who makes that determination? You've got doctors here saying this was not in our standard of care. We will not give this medication because it is below the standard of care. We usually leave that decision up to a doctor. In this case, you're asking a court to step in and say, no, doctor, even though you're saying it's below the standard of care, we, court, have determined that it's necessary. How would we ever make these kinds of decisions when we rely on doctors with the training, the experience, the standard of care, all of the Hippocratic Oath that they take to deliver that standard of care, which they say ivermectin did not meet here. How would we make those distinctions as a court?
First of all, Your Honor, I would say that the standard of care that the Ochin Law Firm representing Aurora has continued to stand by, and in addition to that, the American Medical Association, is it's a contrived standard of care that has come out of the COVID-19 policies, which are coming out of CMS, and they are pretty much a one-size-fits-all here. And we are seeing across the country that ivermectin is being withheld and then remdesivir is being given. But to get back to what we were, but the whole point is that this standard of care has also gone a long way towards nullifying the legislative intent of the rights of patients. And so Alan Gall was not a doctor, but he was standing in the shoes of his principal. And since he was standing in those shoes, he was receiving the information from his doctor in the same way you or I would if we were conscious. But when a principal becomes unconscious, it is that healthcare agent that becomes like the conscience of that person. Counselor. And as they talk to the doctor, and as they get that information, that becomes very important. And Alan Gall talked every day with the doctors.
Counsel?
Yes, sir. I'm sorry.
We have such a short time. I'd like to return to the law here. You advance and cite to 155.30, right? And that deals with the notice that's given, and you've referenced some of the language. In essence, this power of attorney, according to its very terms, gives your agent broad powers to make the health care decisions. Health care decisions is a defined term under the statute. Health care decisions is defined in 155.01 sub 5. Have you, I assume, an opportunity to look at that statute?
Yes.
I know you have, right. I just don't want to, I want to make it as easy as possible. And it says that a health care decision means an informed decision in the exercise of certain rights. You know, and it lists certain what I would call verbs, because they are verbs. So a health care decision means you have the right to, number one, accept, A-C-C-E-P-T, to maintain, to discontinue, or refuse health care. So those are what your rights are, the right to accept health care decision is defined as that, maintain, discontinue, or refuse. I observe that it doesn't say you have the right to request or right to demand. It doesn't say you have the right to begin. It uses instead what four verbs are used to define healthcare decision. And I don't understand the facts here, which I take to be more of you're requesting, you're demanding, you want it to begin, consistent with the definition of healthcare decision. So can you respond to that?
Yes, I can. Thank you. First of all, that is the second page where you found that. That is on the second page of the healthcare power of attorney. The first page is the page where the rights are located.
Yeah, I'm looking at the statutes, so that's...
Right. Okay, I'm sorry.
Yeah, 155.01 sub 5 definitions, healthcare decision.
Correct. But again, when you go to the statute and when you go to the statutory form that is given to every principal when they are going to execute that document, the first page says, in addition to refusing treatment, you have the right to receive necessary health care treatment. The best way I can explain this is part of the statute and it's required. And it's very clear that we are to, if we're to hand this document out, you can't leave off the first page because it states the rights. You have to have page 1 through 6. But what I would also say to you regarding that is on in subsection 2, the legislature was so concerned about making sure that people understood their rights that I, as an attorney, can do a custom form. I can do my own form, as you know. But I am required under the statute to give the first page of rights. If I don't give the first page of rights, at the bottom when I sign my name, I have to attest to the fact that I have told my clients about their rights. And the place where I find their rights is on the first page of the statutory form that says that patients, people, citizens of Wisconsin are entitled to necessary health care, and it may not be stopped or withheld if you object. And so that is where I would find that, and I would say this is where the appeals court erred in not recognizing that. And they basically said that that part of the statute was basically informative and instructional, but that is inaccurate because the instructions come on an earlier page. There are two pages that normally come before that that are in the statutory form that is held, handed out by Wisconsin. I'm sorry, I'm finished here.
You may finish your sentence.
That is normally handed out by the Department of Health. And that those two pages that preface that are where the instructions come from. Clearly, the legislative intent was to give Wisconsin citizens rights and the right to receive necessary treatment. Thank you.
Thank you. Also?
May it please the court. It's my pleasure to speak to you today on behalf of not only Aurora, the hospital, but on behalf of its specialists who actually treated this.
Can you just tip your mic up? Can you tip your mic up a little bit? It's hard to hear. Yeah, okay. Thank you.
Thank you. To represent not only Aurora, but also its team of specialists and its physicians who rendered care to Mr. Zingsheim in this case. There are a few things that seem to come up in the briefs that I think might need to be clarified in terms of potential misapprehensions. I think first, one that comes up frequently, I think, is that Dr. Hagen, the individual who prescribed this medication, was in fact Mr. Zingsheim's physician. I believe a careful review of the affidavits will indicate he in fact never had a physician-patient relationship with Mr. Zingsheim. He never treated him. He didn't know of him. He never reviewed his records. It would be an improper characterization to say that he was in fact Mr. Zingsheim's physician. One other mischaracterization perhaps that we might need to address because it came up in some of the amicus briefs is that it was the hospital, Aurora Summit, which made decisions or which declined to administer ivermectin in this case to Mr. Zingsheim. And that is respectfully, I would say, not an accurate representation here. There are affidavits that have been placed in the records, particularly from Dr. Holmberg and Dr. Letzer, who were members of the treatment team, whose affidavits established that, in fact, they have personal knowledge of the treatment that was being rendered to Mr. Zingsheim. They had access to his records. They had spoken and worked with a team of specialists that comprised four different teams of specialties that were providing care. They have patient-specific information for him that they are able to render. It was their decision, and they established through those affidavits. It was the doctor's decisions who were making the case. Nothing in the affidavits or any materials to indicate that the hospital had any type of treatment protocol that was governing or that was forcing the doctors to act in any specific way.
Are you saying that the hospital then had not determined that the administration of ivermectin was below the standard of care required in the hospital for the treatment of COVID-19?
Your Honor, it is the position of the doctors, and one of the factors that they addressed.
My question goes to the hospital, because that's what you're talking about. you said to us the hospital didn't preclude this. And my question to you is, my reading of the record made me believe that the hospital decided that the provision of ivermectin was below the standard of care that the hospital had set. Now, I know physicians are the ones that work with the board to set the standard of care for the hospital. So I just want to be sure, was this below the standard of care that the hospital required or not?
No, the hospital did not require any particular standard of care. The standard of care is determined by the individual physicians. In fact,
it'd be an unusual hospital to have a standard of care and for treatments that go on in the hospital, but Aurora doesn't have that, right?
Well, Your Honor, the hospital does not actually practice medicine in and of it.
I get that. I'm married to a physician now for more than 60 right. years, if you can believe. So I know a little bit about what doctors do. But they work in conjunction with the hospital. And I just want to be sure that I don't misunderstand. The hospital had no standard of care that the administration of ivermectin would have caused a problem with.
That's correct, Your
okay,
Honor.
Good. Thank right. you. Thank you. That helped me because I thought otherwise.
Let me pursue that a bit more. You have in the hospital structure a board of directors. Did the board of directors pass a resolution addressing the standard of care?
Addressing the standard of care with regard to the ivermectin?
That's correct. Thank you.
In this particular case, Your Honor, there is no evidence in the record to indicate that they passed such a resolution or that it had any effect upon the doctor's decision.
Did the hospital administration issue any kind of directive regarding it?
Your Honor, the record is devoid of any indication that the hospital administration had any type of directive that they required the doctors to use. Moreover, that's inconsistent with the representations of the doctors in their sworn affidavits in which they state conclusively that it was the medical decisions of the physicians that that governed the care in this case.
And the ethics committee rendered a decision here?
Your Honor, again, the record is devoid of any indication that the hospital was coercing or requiring the physicians to render any particular type of care. The physicians certainly would be subject to review by the hospital if they were acting unethically or if they were acting contrary to the standard of care or if there were a pattern of that, because the hospital does have a responsibility to credential its physicians. That's by law and that's by regulation. So they do have to credential the physicians. But in this particular case, the care that was rendered to Mr. Zingsheim was determined by the care providers, by Dr. Letzer and by the other teams of specialists that were provided to him.
Thank
so
you.
It really isn't an accurate characterization to say that it was Aurora stopping the care. If, in fact, the doctors had said that a particular medication was appropriate for this patient, they could have and would have prescribed that and used that as part of the care. In fact, that does
go... Why does that matter? I'm trying to figure out why that matters to our legal analysis. We're reviewing a discretionary decision of the trial court, and we're simply looking to whether the trial court conducted some analysis of whether there's a reasonable likelihood of success on the merits, whether the trial court made some reasonable determination regarding the status quo and irreparable harm and the other factors. I'm trying to figure out why that matters in this case. Analytically.
As to whether the trial court made any determinations in this case as to whether the...
Well, you're raising a point about who was conducting the care, standard of care, hospital policy, doctors. Why does that matter? In terms of the legal question that's before us.
Well, in particular, it matters mostly because of some of the arguments that were being advanced by some of the amicus, which seemed to draw a distinction between the hospital itself and the care providers, the team of doctors that were providing the care for the patients. It's also important to understand that the standard of care is set forth, for instance, in jury instruction 1023. It's basically in treating a plaintiff's or a patient's condition, the doctor is required to use the degree of care, skill, and judgment which a reasonable physician of the specialty in which he practices would exercise in the same or similar circumstances and having due regard to the state of medical science at the time. Standard of care cannot be determined, however, in a vacuum. It can only be determined with reference and with application to a specific patient at a given time. No two patients are the same. The clinical condition of no two patients are the same. That bears upon the contents of the affidavits that are in this case, because there are four affidavits in the record that the trial court was presented. There are two from the hospital, which was Dr. Letzer and Dr. Holmberg, and then there were two, one of which was Dr. Hagen, the prescribing physician, and one of which was Dr. Corey, who styles himself as the expert on ivermectin. This, the standard of care, the fact that it has to be patient-specific is very important in there, because that's what's utterly lacking, completely lacking in the record. From the records of, or from the affidavits of Dr. Hagen and from the affidavit of Dr. Corey, there is nothing in either of those affidavits to indicate that they have any personal knowledge as to Mr. Zink. What medications was he taking? What was his current COVID status? In fact, that came up at the hearing on October 13th, that he had just tested negative. He was no longer positive at that time. Dr. Hagen didn't know that. Dr. Corey didn't know that. In fact, Dr. Corey's affidavit didn't even mention Mr. Zingsheim. The Corey affidavit was not subscribed, or it was not the affidavit was not notarized. It had no particular information about Mr. Zingsheim specifically. There was actually no evidence in the record that the court could consider that was patient-specific and that would bear even upon whether there was a reasonable standard of care that could be met here, or that, or whether the administration of ivermectin was even reasonable with respect to Mr. Zingsheim specifically. Because we can't address this issue in a vacuum. We can't just say the question of whether ivermectin or this particular treatment was the standard of care.
But counsel, we're not being called upon to determine what the standard of care is in COVID-19. None of us are doctors. We're judges. One of us is married to a doctor. It's probably as close as the court comes to medical knowledge. But that's not what we're weighing here. This is not supposed to be a debate about the efficacy of ivermectin as a treatment for COVID. I think a number of my colleagues have already mentioned we are reviewing a discretionary decision of the trial court. And so our task is not to make these factual determinations. We are an appellate court. We are not the fact finders here. And so what we have to determine is whether the circuit court in this case correctly applied the law, identified the law, identified facts, and made a reasoned decision applying the law to the facts. So when I'm looking at the lengthy transcripts over a couple of hearings, it appears to me, based on my review of the record, that the circuit court correctly identified the legal factors that he needed to consider in order to determine whether to issue a temporary injunction. He also had extensive discussion about the facts that he heard, the evidence that he reviewed, the evidence he would disregard because an affidavit wasn't notarized. So he went through that. Now, I will say it doesn't, you know, it's not a perfect transcript, but they really aren't ever perfect transcripts, because trial courts, especially under these types of circumstances, have to make decisions really quickly. So as appellate courts, we're not to look for perfection where each and every factor is identified and then there's a nice itemization in the record of the facts on which, or the findings that the court made. So I guess my broader question to you is why, what is the basis for your argument that the trial court erroneously exercised his discretion?
Absolutely, Your Honor. Your Honor is correct that the trial judge did identify the factors that he needed to consider. For example, the irreparable harm, preservation of the status quo, reasonable probability of success on the merits. What the transcripts are missing, however, is an actual then description of exactly what it is that he was basing his decision on in those respects. For instance, if he's coming to the determination that there was irreparable harm, what is the underlying factor that he considered? What is it irreparable harm in this case? In terms of preserving the status quo, what is it that he heard? What evidence did he rely upon? What record did he create to establish that, in fact, the administration of 66 milligrams of ivermectin would not be a change in the standard of the status quo, to maintain the status quo, he would need that medication.
Well, since you're talking about the status quo, it's important to define what is the status quo? And I'm seeing two different perspectives from the parties. Is it the status quo for the moving party? Because his status quo was, and I'm going to generalize a bit here, but the hospital basically, or the doctors at the hospital basically said, there's nothing more we can do. We'll keep him on a ventilator and provide palliative care to keep him comfortable. There was nothing offered to him. The other side is saying, look, he has a right to try. That's a law that was invoked by the appellate court dissent. So what is the status quo from your perspective? Do you disagree that it's focusing on the status quo for the moving party?
Well, Your Honor, we would take the position that the status quo at the time of the petition was that Mr. Zingsheim was being a team of four different specialties, including critical care, including pulmonary medicine, 24 hours per day, supported by the nursing staff, under a protocol that the treatment team had decided based upon the evidence and based upon the medical condition and his current clinical condition. They were treating under that treatment plan, and that treatment plan did not include ivermectin. That was the status quo at the time. So when the judge actually made his decision in this case and initially granted the injunction, he was actually not preserving the status quo. He was actually actively upsetting the status quo, whereas prior to that, the patient had been treated by a team of specialists under their the medical discretion in terms of their treatment plan that did not include ivermectin. He was now being required, or the treatment team was now being required, to administer ivermectin, a change in the treatment plan.
But that's disrupting the status quo for Aurora, but it's not disrupting the status quo for Mr. Zingsheim, who was trying to live, right? The status quo for him was he was alive, and they were trying to keep him alive.
Well, when we go, then that goes back to the area of what medical evidence did this judge have to base that upon? And we go back to those only four. We had four doctors in the records. And when we look at them, we can't just assume that because the doctor who prescribed the medication, and just because the doctor who styles himself as the expert on ivermectin, just because they have affidavits in the record, necessarily bear upon the standard of care or bear upon what is appropriate treatment for this.
But it sounds like you're asking us to reweigh the evidence, and if we reweigh the evidence, perhaps this court would come to a different determination than the circuit court did, but that's not our role, right? There was evidence presented on both sides, and wasn't it the circuit court's decision to make in that instance? The circuit court was a fact finder. We're not.
Well, Your Honor, the problem is that the circuit court did not make a record in terms of what it was basing its decision on. And in fact, the law that we've cited to the court is that an erroneous exercise of discretion in the context of a temporary injunction occurs when the circuit court fails to consider and make a record of the factors relevant to that determination or considers clearly irrelevant or improper factors. In this instance, we would take the position that the trial court did indeed factors relevant to its determination and also considered clearly irrelevant or improper factors to the extent that the trial court considered the affidavits of Dr. Hagen and Dr. Corey.
But that standard goes to legal factors, and on this record, the circuit court, and I think you conceded that, did identify the factors to be considered in determining whether or not to issue an injunction.
He did state the factors that should be required or should be recognized, but he didn't state exactly what it was that was satisfying those factors. And to this day, we don't have a record of what it was that supposedly satisfied those factors.
So, counsel, with respect to the likelihood of success on the merits, for example, I know that Justice Bradley talked about the right to try that was thrown out by the appellate court. What was the law here that was argued, number one? It certainly wasn't the three things argued today in the briefs
right
to us. So what was the law argued, and what law did the circuit court rely on to make this finding, supposedly, that there was a likelihood of success on the merits? Was that made at all?
Well, Your Honor, it would be our contention that there really was no law that was relied upon by the court. The court seems to have made a decision. I can't put myself into the head of the judge, but he did not cite to any law. No cases, no law that would specifically justify this. In fact, it really, we should not lose sight of the fact as well that a number of cases, somewhere on the order of 8 or 10 or 12, have been cited in the briefs that where this very issue has been considered by other courts in other states. This is not the first go-round where this has happened. And it should be mentioned, or noted at least, that in none of those cases has a grant of an injunction of this nature been upheld on appellate review. In none of those cases has that happened. In every case, even when an injunction was initially granted by the circuit court, it was always invalidated or overturned when appellate review is applied to it. That's the problem here, is that there is none. And in fact, the cases that were cited do indicate no court has recognized, certainly no cases that I could find, has recognized a constitutional or a legal or a statutory right for any individual patient to be able to request or demand a treatment of his or her choice and to have that treatment.
So in response to that, I think...
But that's not what the court ordered, right? The court ordered that, not that Aurora had to administer the treatment, the court ordered that Aurora had to allow a physician to come in and administer the treatment, and not just anybody, not necessarily Dr. Hagen, because the court's order was also clear that the doctor had to be acceptable to Aurora, in other words, meet its credentialing criteria. So Aurora didn't have to do anything other than open the door, right?
Ultimately, there were two orders that were issued here, and the first one did, in fact, require the Aurora.
But the second one didn't.
The second one was a change, and that also goes back to another potential misapprehension here as well. There was never an agreement whereby Aurora agreed to allow someone to come on, a doctor of Mr. Gall's choice. That was a function of the fact that the court decided at the second hearing to modify the order slightly. He maintained his order that Aurora was to, or that the ivermectin should be administered, but he changed the order slightly such that a doctor of the choice of Mr. Gall would be chosen, and we would have to, the hospital would have to then emergently credential that individual to allow that individual to administer the ivermectin. That, however, is equally problematic for the reasons set forth in the briefing, because essentially, while the trial court attempted to set up a system whereby the hospital wouldn't need to take responsibility for any bad outcome that might occur as a result of ivermectin, they were still required to emergently credential a physician who was going to be chosen for no reason other, no criteria other than that that physician was willing to issue a to a non-patient sight unseen. That was going to happen. In order to identify a physician that Aurora would need to credential, Mr. Gall would have to find a physician who was willing to say, I will give you a prescription, just get me into the hospital, I'll administer it. But in order to do so, because we don't have a treating doctor here, that physician is necessarily going to have to be chosen by Mr. Gall based on one condition and one condition only, a willingness, like Dr. Hagen, to administer or to prescribe a prescription sight unseen to a non-patient. This in itself is problematic because we know from the record that the medical examining board has already spoken on this and has actually had disciplined Dr. Hagen in the past 7 years earlier for doing something very similar to what he did in this very case, for providing a prescription to a non-patient, someone he had not seen, he had not treated, he had not done a physical examination for that patient. He was reprimanded by the court as for improper or essentially unprofessional treatment. Yet that's exactly what he's doing here. So that second order of the court actually was equally problematic to the first. The hospital has a legal duty, both under Wisconsin case law and under the administrative code, to credential its physicians. And patients rely upon the decisions of the hospital credentialing its decisions.
What does it take to get credentialed in the general course so that we understand what that means? Sure. Because you read that and you say, okay, so what? They were going to let him come in, and I know you've talked about it a little bit, but what does that process entail?
Well, Your Honor, I mean, I haven't sat on a credentialing committee myself, but there is a credentialing committee that's required to have that.
Is it in the record, Counselor?
I'm sorry?
Is what you're going to tell us in the record?
Are there any credentialing records in record?
Is what you're going to say in answer to Justice Dallet's question information that's found in the record?
Your Honor, no. There's nothing in the record to deal with.
Okay, that's fine. I don't want you to say, I don't want you to answer something outside the record, but is there, but it is in the record a description that it is a, it's a process, correct? You have at least detailed that in your briefs.
I'm sorry, Your
credentialing,
Honor?
Credentialing, that it's a process, that
yes.
It's something that isn't just, you just say to a doctor, okay, come on in and do whatever you want in our hospital?
That is correct, Your Honor. The credentialing is a process that has to be done. It would have to be done under the second court order. It would have to be done emergently. The court required that Aurora run whatever physician Mr. Gall found who was willing to prescribe the medication would have to be credentialed, but they were required to credential that individual, which of course is you're taking away the decision-making power of the hospital on a very important issue. One of the reasons you might choose not to credential a physician is because that physician is willing to prescribe a medication that is not to your patient and is prescribed sight unseen. That's improper conduct. That could be medical malpractice. A doctor who's willing to do that is perhaps a doctor that you might not want to credential for the safety of your patients.
I want to ask you a question.
We were required to do that.
I want to ask you to respond to an argument on the other side concerning 155.30(1), and as I understand the argument on the other side, that this power of attorney for health care instrument, the form statute, the first sentence says you have the right to make decisions about your health care. No health care may be given to you over your objection, and necessary health care may not be stopped or withheld if you object. I understand that this was not an argument made before the circuit court, but it is an argument that's being brought before us today, and I just wanted to give you the opportunity to respond to that.
Yes, Your Honor, absolutely. This was not an issue that was necessarily brought up to the circuit court. This was not even an issue that the circuit court mentioned or dealt with in any way. In fact, as the briefing indicates, this particular statute merely sets out statutory language that must be included on health care. We know when interpreting a statute, the plain meaning of that statute, you have to interpret that in the context in which it's used and not in isolation. Wisconsin courts have also recognized that powers of attorney are to be strictly construed, and they're only to be construed to grant those powers that are clearly delineated or clearly specified in that power of attorney. A healthcare decision under Chapter 155.01(5) is an informed decision in the exercise of the right to accept, maintain, discontinue, or refuse healthcare. Nowhere in that definition does it state a right to demand or receive on demand a particular form of care, whether that's ivermectin or a surgical procedure.
Counselor, in regard to that, the request to receive a particular care, does WISSTAT 450.137, which is labeled access to investigated drugs, devices, and products, does that have any bearing on this case, that access statute?
No, Your Honor. Actually, that is the, as I understand what you're referencing, is the right to try statute, essentially.
Yeah, it's the right to try, and that's right. What he was asking for, the right to try ivermectin.
Yeah. Your Honor, that would have no bearing on this case. Number one, it was never particularly argued. In fact, I believe when one looks at the transcripts of the hearing, Mr. Gall's counsel was not even aware as to whether there was a right to try statute. There is, in fact, a right to try statute, but when you look at that statute, it is very narrowly. Only certain patients, certain individuals fall under that, and only certain investigational devices and drugs fall under that. In this particular case, when you apply the statutory criteria under right to try, ivermectin would not fall under that, which is maybe why it was not argued in this particular case.
So I'm really trying to stay focused on the law here, and I don't want to redo the analysis done below. So we've gotten basically four legal theories that have been thrown out on the merits, and I find it. Why are you not arguing that these issues like the 155.30 are forfeited? Because we're reviewing a trial court's decision. We don't normally, after the fact, when you're talking about whether the trial court made a reasoned application of the law, find a totally new law that the trial court didn't actually consider in the first place. And so, why I'm trying to figure out what we're supposed to do with that. It's a very odd posture for us to be in, just sort of spitballing different theories that come up after the fact that weren't even there before the trial court. The trial court didn't rely on the right to try, didn't rely on 15530, and it didn't cite any law. What are we as a reviewing court supposed to do when the trial court doesn't actually engage in an analysis on the merits at all, doesn't actually cite any legal authority?
Well, Your Honor, essentially, we would say that the Court of Appeals got it right in this case. There is, in fact, as the Court of Appeals noted, there is no law conferring the right that's being requested here, the right to
demand. And we don't need to say that, right? I mean, maybe there is in some circumstance and some other time. I don't like to say too much more than we need to. I mean, the only question before us is whether the trial court erroneously exercised its discretion when it decided to exercise judicial authority to order Aurora to do something. And whether it had any lawful basis to do it that was before it, such that there was a reasonable probability of success in the merits. That's it. That's the only question before us. There are the other factors as a part of the temporary injunction as well that also have to be met. But if you don't meet that, you've run us exercise your discretion, end of case. Trial court, you know, then would be reversed, right?
Your Honor, it would be our position that the trial court did not have any have a basis. The trial court did abuse its discretion. It did not indicate the factors it was considering. It did not identify any law upon it which it was basing its decision. The trial judge was put in a very difficult position, which illustrates the problem and the concern of putting the judiciary in the way between the doctor and the patient, because he's faced with an argument here that make a quick decision. And this is not a case where a doctor or a judge is parsing medical evidence to determine perhaps admissibility under the Daubert standard. He's being asked to parse evidence and make medical decisions that are going to actively affect the treatment. It's going to overrule the treatment decisions by an independent, educated professional.
Counsel, is there anything in the law that requires the trial court judge to identify the particular law? Because in the transcript, and I'm going to quote from it, the circuit court said, this court has a significant respect for an individual's right to choose and choose their treatment. And of course, this is expressed in Martin v. Richards, which was cited by the dissent in this case. It's 192 with second 156. That case identified the right to make their own health care decisions for patients, the right to informed consent, which means that physicians must disclose what a reasonable person in the patient's position would want to know, and finally, the right to request and receive medically viable alternative treatments and have that choice respected by her or his doctor. Of course, there was a great debate among the experts presented to the circuit court in this case about whether the proposed treatment was medically viable, but there was testimony to the effect that the treatment was medically viable. So is it enough that the circuit court said this court has a significant respect for an individual's right to choose and choose their treatment, which has a basis in the law?
Your Honor, I would note that my time is up.
You may answer the question.
Okay.
In this particular case,
it would be the contention of the hospital that the trial court erroneously exercised its discretion to the extent that it did consider any of the affidavits submitted by Mr. not properly submitted, and they did not have any patient specific documentation in them. Therefore, reliance upon those affidavits to establish that this was a potentially medically viable treatment to which there was a reasonable choice would not be an appropriate exercise of discretion by the trial court in the first instance.
Okay, thank you. Rebuttal.
Your Honors, Aurora Hospital agreed to the treatment. They have over and over again throughout the record talked about how the patient's well-being is their priority. If they were so concerned about the ivermectin being a danger to Mr. Zingzheim, I would certainly think that would have been a great opportunity to risk the contempt of the court, and they did not. Secondly, regarding this document.
Wait, are you saying that because Aurora didn't somehow violate a court order, they were below the standard of care? I don't understand what your argument is, and I don't understand the relevance to this lawsuit.
Well, what I am saying is that regarding the standards of care, they were COVID-19 protocols that came out of the federal government, and that became the standard of care. And because they were COVID-19 protocols, there were reimbursements that the board of directors of Aurora would have been concerned about. And
is that in the record? What you're making an argument that goes well beyond what the case is here, right? About who got reimbursed for what?
I would ask the court to take judicial notice of the fact that Medicare, Medicaid gives reimbursements, and that in order to get reimbursements...
Let me ask you a question, then, okay. If you're going to introduce things that are outside the record. Did Dr. Hagen ever see the patient in this case?
He did not.
Did he ever previously treat him?
He did not.
Did he have access to his medical records?
He did not.
What type of medicine does that Dr. Hagen practice?
Excuse me?
What type of medicine does he practice? Is he an infectious disease doctor?
He is not.
What type of medicine does he practice?
He's a retired OBGYN specialist.
Mr. Zingsheim, I'm assuming, is a male, correct?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And he was sanctioned for unprofessional conduct, wasn't he, because he prescribed medication to a non-patient without considering a proper medical examination, or conducting, excuse me, a medical examination. Is that true?
There were charges from DSPS regarding that.
And it's also my understanding that the dosage he came up with, which was 66 milligrams of ivermectin for 5 days, was extremely high given how Mr. Zingsheim presented, that is, his height and his weight. Is that true?
Yes.
Counsel, you didn't argue the right to try statute before us. You're not relying on that. Is that also correct?
I'm sorry.
You did not argue the right to try statute before us at all. Wasn't one of the three grounds that you raised. You're not relying on that, correct?
The right to try statute is certainly, it matters regarding the spirit. And that comes down to legislative intent, not primarily of 155.30, subsection 2, because we're talking about the legislature wanting to make sure that patients had the ability to ask for and to receive treatment that may not be preferred by the hospitals if it was necessary.
How do we know that from the language in the statute?
How do we know that's the language of the
statute? How do we know that from? We're supposed to read the statute, and then we're supposed to read the words in the statute and interpret the statute based on the words in the statute, and you're asking us to take a leap from what the words in the statute say to what you are telling us the intent of the legislature.
What I'm saying is that the appellate court, the appeals court, did make that leap, and they made a determination that those words were only informative and instructive when, in fact, they were directly part of the legislative intent. That first page of the statutory form is required when any hospital or any other health care agency or department hands them out to people, so that the people of Wisconsin know what they can expect if they are ever in the situation where they need a healthcare agent to make the decisions for them. And this statute informs them that they have those rights.
Has this argument been successful in any appellate court in the country?
It has not been. And what I would say to that, Your Honor, respectfully, is that we don't live in Texas or Pennsylvania or any other state. This is a statute that was formed by the legislature in Wisconsin. And the people of Wisconsin would ask that you clarify what the meaning is here so that they understand if they have any ability to ask for care when they go to the hospital. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Very interesting arguments. Thank you for your presentations here today. The court is adjourned. We will reconvene at 1:30 for the third oral argument of the day.